Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. In this two-program set, we examine the health of the planet with Katherine Thomason of Physicians for Social Responsibility. We talk about global climate disruptions and their effects on human health and what we can do about it. Today, my guest is Katherine Thomason. She's a physician who lives in Portland and has worked for some long years with the Oregon chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. And am I remembering right, Katherine, that you've been a past president?
Yes, I have been past president here in Oregon and at the national level.
And at the national level as well. How many years have you worked with PSR?
Over 10 years.
Over 10 years. Great. Excellent. Well, I always like to ask people a little bit about how they got into their chosen field. So tell me, had you always wanted to be a physician, or how did you become attracted to the field?
My father always felt that people ought to know what they wanted to do in life.
Ah.
And I think that kind of pressure made me pick the field that I thought would be the best field I could think of, which was being a physician.
Oh.
So in college, I had to rethink that.
Well, I'm glad you did rethink it, because pressure is one thing, but it can sometimes lead you the wrong direction. So that was great. So you rethought it and still wanted to continue, and did.
I did. And I went to school in Detroit, Michigan.
Oh.
We had an excellent medical school, actually, right in downtown Detroit. And I learned an awful lot about lack of care and other kinds of care. And because of the setting, I believe, and going to undergrad for 4 years in downtown Detroit, I actually worked on getting a master's in public health at the same time I was in medical school.
Oh.
Because I feel that, you know, dealing with our surroundings, dealing mm-hmm. with the health of our air, water, planet, and our sociological health is also, in fact, probably more important than our medical health.
Mm-hmm. And you did that at the early age, so just when you were getting the MD itself. What did you do after you completed the MD?
I did what most everyone does, which is move right into your training for your specialty.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what led me to Portland.
Oh.
I came out to Portland to do my residency in internal medicine right after. Because you can't really practice until you've at least done an internship in most states.
And that's 2 years or three?
Three.
So you worked at OHSU at that time?
I did. Mm-hmm. I came out and did the academic OHSU residency training. And I chose it because it had a primary care track. I wanted to make sure that I was going to be educated in taking care of people in the outpatient setting, not just in the hospital.
And that is a very needed, quote, specialty. It's a general specialty in a way, isn't it? One of the people I've talked with on this program said he thought about that. He really wanted to do that. He wanted to work with people, but he realized he just had to know so very much. It was very demanding. Is that your impression?
Well, I'm not sure. I think that nowadays, with the ability to have physicians work just in the hospital, to be a hospitalist, that having to know all the intricacies and intensity of medicine when people are so very sick is not as needed if people are not mm-hmm. going to be an intensivist or in the hospital. Well, I think that's why I was looking for primary care in mm-hmm. internal medicine, is because at the time when I was going through residency in 1983 to 86, mm-hmm. there was so much to learn in the hospital that mm-hmm. things like sprained ankles and rashes mm-hmm. and the routine things that you'd see in an outpatient setting, you didn't necessarily get exposed to.
Mm.
So during my residency, I came to understand some of the issues around our foreign policy here in the United States, and I did work around educating people about what was happening in Central America, and then mm-hmm. I got involved in healthcare access issues. And most recently, in the last 10 or 12 years, I've been working with Physicians for Social Responsibility in the areas of our foreign policy and why we didn't get our peace dividend, but primarily, most recently, in climate change.
Yeah, that peace dividend is really an interesting thing, isn't it? We can all remember for a year or two that was the big concern, at least that the media said. I'm sure that it had already been decided by some people who didn't talk about it out loud at that time. Anyway, we could talk about foreign policy for a very long time.
Well, climate change has its own component of foreign policy.
It certainly does. And the failure, partial failure, of some of the last big international conferences on this issue are very obvious. But we haven't really seen much in the media about the health effects of global climate change. You hear a little bit about the heat waves, for instance, that hit Europe, and some of the other more obvious kinds of things of the movement of some of the infectious diseases with the insects that carry them, of course. Incidentally, I wonder what will happen to Nepal. Before I went, I looked up the altitude level that the malaria-carrying mosquitoes went to. It was about 4,100 feet, if I remember at that time. Well, Kathmandu and Pokhara, the two cities that I primarily visited, are just a few hundred feet higher than that. And I thought, oh, that's great. I don't want to take anti-malarial drugs. But I'm wondering, even in places like that, if the parasites will be able to move a little bit higher up the slope. Well, let's talk about some of the topics that come up with global climate change. And it isn't just heat, is it? It's changing weather and winds, fierce winds. So what are the different weather phenomena that come with global climate change that make an impact on health?
Well, I think it's very important to everyone to understand that climate change is already happening. Mm-hmm. I think one of the biggest changes, of course, and the easiest one to see is average temperature. But, you know, average temperature is kind of a bell curve. So mm-hmm. You always get the extremes. You get really cold or you can get really hot. Here in Oregon, where we don't always get too cold, we can get too hot. And that does affect health. Humans, because we're able to adapt much more readily than other species in the environment, more and more people are getting air conditioning. More and more people are understanding that they need to get out of the heat to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. So we are seeing an increased number of heat waves, and that certainly is going to impact health. And it may not impact your or my health because we are able to take care of ourselves, but it really affects the very young mm-hmm. who can't adapt as well or take care of themselves without any help, and the older people or the people who have illnesses. People who take medications that keep them from sweating normally, people who need more hydration and aren't realizing that they're not getting enough. Mm-hmm. So heat waves are the most obvious health impact, and we are seeing that. As you mentioned, yes. The European heat wave in 2003 caught everybody by surprise. It's estimated anywhere from 15,000 people died in that heat wave, mm-hmm. which was about two and a half weeks long. A more recent heat wave here in the United States occurred in California a year or two ago. And while it had many fewer human deaths, there was huge die-offs of cattle, chickens, because they can't get into air conditioning.
Right, right.
So we are really, truly mm-hmm. seeing effects of the overproduction and release of carbon into the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And how do we release carbon in the atmosphere? Well, we release it by burning things. So when we burn wood, we release carbon dioxide. But that carbon dioxide was put into the wood through the natural process because, of course, plants need carbon dioxide just like we need oxygen.
Yeah, and we need the plants because they give us the oxygen.
That's right. So when we burn oil and coal that have been put down in the earth millions and millions of years ago, we are releasing an over amount of carbon than is normally in the carbon cycle. Mm-hmm. So people need to, you know, get in their minds that what we're doing is releasing too much carbon into the atmosphere. And that's the mm-hmm. driver behind all the changes that mm-hmm. we are seeing and that we will see in the future.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's the methane.
Right. And methane has carbon in it, too.
Yeah.
Right. So natural gas is methane. Cows produce methane.
Yeah. And rice agriculture.
Rice agriculture.
It's been found that 6,000 years ago, when rice agriculture was developing and getting to be very, very popular, you know, in Asia, the methane levels actually went up, as recorded in the ice in Greenland.
Right.
It's measurable. It's not anything like what's going on today, mind you, but it is measurable. It's fascinating.
And that's an important point. People think, well, somebody says that it's not happening and other people say that it is, but you know, everyone is agreeing. We have higher levels
right.
of carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere today than measured in the last 650,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it is measurable. You're absolutely mm-hmm. right. And you know what? Everyone is in agreement about that.
Yeah.
And the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, which is actually a consortium of representatives from governments all around the world, and scientists that look at all available data, whether it agrees with what the current theories are mm-hmm. about climate mm-hmm. change or not, they look at all that information,
yeah,
compile it, and put out reports. The latest mm-hmm. report, of course, coming out in 2007. And there hasn't been any government, including our own, that has countered or contradicted
the data.
The data.
The hard data, the data.
That's right.
Yeah. The interpretation is apparently what some individuals like to slipperily massage in certain ways, or whatever you want to call it.
Right. And so, you know, it's increase in carbon, whether it's carbon dioxide, mm-hmm. methane, and of course there's a few other greenhouse gases, but those are the big ones.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And trees grow slowly, so planting a tree is a good thing, but it's a long-term thing, and it has to be coupled with reducing the burning at the same time.
I think the most important thing, too, is that the benefits that will come if we begin to think about, well, can we do anything about it? It's a global problem. How can I, one individual mm-hmm. or you, another individual, do anything about it? You know, collectively, we can do a lot. And the benefits from making the changes that we need to reduce our carbon footprint, to reduce mm-hmm. the amount of carbon that we're putting out into the atmosphere, the benefits that we will reap from that are myriad.
Mm.
So
mm-hmm.
the mm-hmm. most common cause of air pollution in the world is burning fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can stop burning coal and stop burning oil and reduce our natural gas burning, we're going to reduce the major forms of air pollution.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that be fabulous?
Yeah, and that relates to the big plant in Boardman.
It's the single most intensive source of carbon emissions in the state.
In the state.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's not more than all of us driving our cars around.
Yeah.
But in terms of a single source.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. The coal that we burn here in the state is about 8% of our overall electricity production. So when we look at, gee, mm-hmm. how can we reduce our carbon footprint, we look at two major things. We look at our electricity sources
mm-hmm.
and we look at our transportation sources. So in our state, we pat ourselves on the back. We've got lots of hydropower and we don't have very much coal because, you know, way back in 1997, Oregon was the first state to regulate carbon.
That's very nice to hear.
It is. And so the state said any company that wants to build a plant to make electricity needs to produce a plant that is 17% more efficient than the best natural gas burning power plant in that time.
Hmm.
And that if they wanted to build another coal-burning power plant, they weren't told they couldn't, but if they did, they had to pay a tax on the carbon, and it went to the Climate Trust.
And what year was that?
1997.
97, okay. So
since that time, we've had no new coal-burning power plant in the
mm-hmm.
state.
Good.
Now, what that tells us, though, when we say, well, we think we're so good and we can pat ourselves on the back, but if you're a PGE or a Pacific Power customer, we are actually in the state using electricity that 38% of which comes from coal.
Right.
So we are pulling those electrons from a coal strip in Montana or Idaho mm-hmm. or other coal burning power plants in Utah.
Mm-hmm. The grid.
Which is a problem.
Yeah, right. It doesn't stop at the state's borders.
It doesn't stop at the state.
Everything
it's kind
moves.
Of like carbon doesn't stop at the state borders either.
It doesn't stop at the nation borders either.
That's right.
Or ocean.
Right. So ask yourself, well, what can I do? Well, think about how you use electricity. If everyone were to be able to do a lot of improvements on their home, turn off their light switch, put in better light bulbs, when they have to buy a new refrigerator, they buy the most energy efficient one. If we were to do that, we could cut our electricity use in this country by 50%. 50%
just with efficiency. Every household doing this.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Europe which has charged more for electricity, their lifestyle isn't any worse than ours.
Yeah.
And they produce 50% less carbon dioxide per person than the people in the United States. This doesn't mean we have to have a big hardship.
No.
We really can do a lot right now to reduce our carbon footprint.
One of the problems I think Americans have is that they think we're on top of things, ahead of things. But anyone who's ever traveled almost anywhere, well, they're way ahead of us. Of course, when electricity is transmitted farther over wires, it loses some as it goes. And that's one reason that the distributed local produced electricity, such as we're beginning to get into, many of us have solar panels on our roof, but now with the program of groups of people being able to invest in putting solar panels on the roofs of, let's say, public buildings that are not surrounded by shady trees and have really great access to solar, are even, it seems to me, a smarter way to go. But it's nice to have your eyes opened and see that the rest of the world can be way ahead of you. And of course, Germany is often touted for the big investment it's making in locally produced, individual produced solar electricity.
And that really points out the fact that it's important for us to use the market.
Yeah.
For incentives. And the people who produce the solar, so any household that decides to put solar on the top of its roof, gets paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, not only do you have savings, but you also get paid. So any extra electricity that you produce on the top of your roof, you get paid for. And that's called a feed-in tariff.
Mm-hmm. And that's the system that Oregon has started on this very small pilot project, the feed-in tariff. It's also a good one, I think, in the economy as it is now, because it is a local investment that is not likely to go under. People are likely to want electricity for a long time to come. It's not a speculative venture.
Not at all. And that also gets off the coal so that we don't have to draw our electricity from Montana, Utah, and Idaho, or Washington State as well. Because as you mentioned, with the single largest point source being the Boardman coal-burning power plant here in Oregon, that we want to begin to get off of those sources.
Right.
And these are the alternatives that we can use. Again, just getting back just briefly regarding air pollution, when you burn anything, you produce air pollutants. So you're producing particulate matter. When you burn coal, you're producing and releasing a lot of heavy metals that are just naturally occurring in the coal itself. So mercury is being sent up the smokestack, basically. And with any coal-burning power plant, that is going to occur.
So some of these health effects are not just from the extra heat that the planet absorbs and that we all experience, but it's from those particulates, which, what, could be cancer-related?
Particulates can get deep into the lungs and bring along other contaminants that could potentially cause cancer, but more so affecting people with respiratory diseases, causing asthma, as well as exacerbating asthma, worsening other respiratory diseases, increasing heart disease. These are things that happen when we have these particulates that come from the sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxides that are being produced by the coal-burning power plant, as well as acid rain.
Oh, yes, yes. Years ago, that was such a major impact between Canada and the U.S. and the East. And why don't we hear anything much about it? I know a lot of it was corrected at that time. What was that, 20 years, 30 years ago?
Right. They put scrubbers or special kinds of pollution-removing devices on these plants to reduce the amount of sulfur dioxide that went up the smokestack. Boardman doesn't have any.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's producing 12,000 tons of sulfur dioxide every year.
Wow.
And because it's way out in the desert, there aren't a lot of people around there, and the forests are pretty minimal. But in the winter, it comes through the gorge. And this acid rain is washing away beautiful archaeologic findings in the gorge, affecting the forests in the gorge, and of course producing pollution for anyone who lives up the gorge, and even including Portland. So right now, under new rules affecting haze in wilderness areas, in scenic areas, the Boardman plan actually impacts up to 15 different airsheds around wilderness areas and scenic areas. And so it is now agreed with pronouncements from the DEQ that it has to address these. And the first set of pollution controls will go on to the plant in 2012. And so those will control about 80% of the mercury emissions and some of the sulfur dioxide emission. But the costly pollution controls that are slated to go on to that plant in 2014 and 2017, you know, it probably isn't worthwhile for the ratepayers to put those kinds of things on, and that the plant should probably close in 2014 before these pollution devices are required by law to be put in place.
Because they would be terribly expensive, and meanwhile the plant is aging.
$500 million.
Well, and how do they, even if they scrub it, then what do they do with the stuff that they gather?
Bury it.
It's
called ash.
Yeah.
And some of the ash is taken and put into concrete.
Is a real problem too, though, isn't it?
Concrete's a huge problem. And actually, the only benefit, in my opinion, of coal-burning power plants is to be able to use some of the fly ash in the making of concrete so that you don't have to make concrete from scratch.
Mm.
But that's probably the only benefit that we get from coal-burning power plants.
And yet they've been the mainstay, and coal is the major resource for energy that in this country we actually have, I think.
It's about 50% of electricity is from coal-burning power plants. That's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
So we're at a crossroads.
We
have an opportunity right now to make some major changes in our electricity system. First and foremost, of course, efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
But then looking at what are the alternatives and how can we make them more likely to occur through market strategies, through regulation, through caps, such as Oregon has already put in place in terms of saying we can't produce any more CO2.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the things that we need to look at, because if we don't, our health is going to suffer. The health of the planet is going to suffer.
So heat, but all these other intertwined environmental impacts, and that's what's really, really fascinating, because whenever you bring up any of these impacts, it seems to be intertwined with others. And, you know, hydro was this wonderful thing that Woody Guthrie was hired to write songs about and did some wonderful songs back in the Depression. But they went so crazy over dams. And the result, of course, has been damage to our fish, particularly the salmon, the charismatic one of the bunch, I guess you'd say, but other fish and other parts of the ecosystem too. So it seems to be one of the main problems with our society's solutions to things is we find a solution and wow, that's it, yay, we're there. We need to have a more balanced and judicious approach and look at the various health and other impacts of some of these things. In this state, we have access to some wind power as well as straight solar, and then ultimately wave energy is a potential out there.
Yes, it's still being studied.
Yeah.
I think two things that are overlooked, and I don't really understand why one of them isn't as sought after, is concentrated solar. I know that there was a big fight in one of the California deserts about not putting out huge mirrors to, just like you were taught in Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts, you know, if you could concentrate your mirror and
focus
that sun on a little bunch of twig and twine, you'd start a fire because it gets really, really hot. Well, the same thing can be done with the concentrated solar power. And so these big mirrors are put out in areas where you have lots and lots of sun. The rays are concentrated, and it can boil water.
Mm.
And that can run a steam turbine, and we can make electricity from it.
Mm.
So that is one that's actually less expensive than putting photovoltaic cells up on our roof.
Mm.
So that is a possibility, especially for Eastern Oregon, to create some new sources of electricity. And then geothermal. We are doing more exploration. Klamath Falls, of course, the community college there, I think, is run completely on geothermal. And some geothermal explorations are occurring in our eastern mountains. We're right to be cautious. We're right to be concerned about, are we going to harm our Newberry Crater and the beautiful set-aside parks and lands that we have? But if we don't do some of these changes, we're not going to have the same planet as we know and love today.
Yeah.
So I think that getting back to health effects of climate change is that we are seeing, and we will continue to see more, extreme weather events. Mm-hmm. So areas that tend to be dry are going to get drier. Areas that tend to be wet in general are going to get wetter.
Mm-hmm.
So here on the west side, we are going to see more extreme rain. Our humidity level has gone up by 7% already. So if you thought you were hotter in the summer, you really are, because the humidity factor has gone up too.
Now, I know cities make their own little ecology, and they tend to have more humidity because of what people do. But is the humidity going up also in the more rural areas?
Yes.
As well as in the cities where a lot of people are, of course, breathing and contributing heat and humidity as it moves through their bodies.
Going up worldwide, right.
And humidity, of course, intensifies the perception and some of the health effects, negative health effects.
Sure.
And your sweating mechanisms don't work as well when it's humid.
That's right.
It works very well when it's not.
We're going to have harder storms, more rain that's more intense, more snow that's more intense. Just as we saw a number of the huge storms in the east and the Midwest in this last year. Because with the changing weather patterns, we get changing wind patterns.
Yes.
And you get changing wind patterns that brings in more storm activity. We're seeing more, not necessarily more, but certainly more intense hurricanes. Because
yes.
the ocean temperature has increased, which perpetuates a small storm that could potentially turn into a hurricane and allows it to build and build and build. So worldwide, we're seeing more extreme weather events that impact our ability to cope. So, you know, when you get huge floods, you really hurt infrastructure. You can only look at Hurricane Katrina and what it did to New Orleans, and the hurricane itself did part of the damage, but the floods, the broken levees, the inability to keep the water out is what caused the massive devastation, the resulting fungal growth in the homes that are uninhabitable today. Right.
Yeah.
And still uninhabitable. So it takes a long time to rebuild when you have major floods and major storm events.
Catherine Thomason will discuss more health issues and more solutions in part two of this program on the next Health and Healthcare Forum. The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall and is recorded with the help of Joe Magner of Anabyte Electronics and Recording. Theme music is written by Laurie Childers and is performed by Laurie Childers and Kent White.